Partners, LLC, a local bicycle food delivery company delivering to the Portland metro area in an hour or less. More information and a list of local eateries they work with can be found at pdxccc.com.
You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM, K296 FT West Haven serving Portland at 107.1 FM, and K219KU Nehalem serving Nehalem, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm, radio is yours.
News Service Joe Newscast, September the 22nd, 2025. I'm Mike Clifford. President Donald Trump has called on the country's top law enforcement official, Attorney General Pam Bondi, to more aggressively investigate his political adversaries. That from the BBC. The report in a social media post addressed directly to Bondi, he said, "We can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and credibility." Trump expressed frustration that nothing is being done before calling on Bondi to investigate former FBI Director James Comey, New York Attorney General Letitia James, and Democratic Senator Adam Schiff, who oversaw his first impeachment trial. The BBC notes that shortly after, he posted again to praise Bondi, who he said was doing a great job. Meantime, a new analysis finds Pennsylvania's childhood vaccination rates are slipping. For the second year in a row, kindergarten immunization fell below the 95% target set by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Becky Lutwit with Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children says state data show a steady decline over the past 7 years, even before COVID-19. The report highlights a decline in vaccinations for measles, mumps, and rubella, otherwise known as MMR vaccines.
In the most recent school year available, we saw that there were almost 8,000 kindergartners who weren't up to date on their MMR vaccine. That has doubled since the 2017-2018 school year.
The report notes that falling MMR vaccination rates nationwide has left some communities vulnerable to measles outbreaks. Lutwit adds other recommended vaccinations are also trending downward. Nationally, 93% of kindergartners are covered, and from 2023 to 2024, only 11 states reached the 95% benchmark. Danielle Smith reporting.
And health and safety advocates are opposing parts of the Trump administration's Make America Healthy Again plan that would shield pesticide manufacturers from most liability lawsuits.
Republicans in Congress are sponsoring legislation that would roll back consumer protections against PFAS, otherwise known as forever chemicals, that may cause cancer. Rebecca Wolf with the group Food and Water Watch refers to the Agricultural Labeling Uniformity Act as the Cancer Gag Act, adding it's a gift to industrial agriculture.
What we're seeing is a concerted effort or a real campaign from Bayer pushing to shield pesticide manufacturers from health-related lawsuits, as well as hamper the EPA's ability to better regulate these toxic chemicals.
A similar measure failed to pass in the Idaho Senate in 2024. It would have provided legal protection to pesticide manufacturers from the state's failure to warn liability law. Proponents of the legislation argued it would have provided relief from lawsuits for overburdened manufacturing companies. Mark Richardson reporting.
This is Public News Service. Regulators in Minnesota are weighing feedback on a potential policy change tied to natural gas infrastructure. The state could phase out gas line extension allowances, where current ratepayers cover the cost of connecting new development to these systems.
The Public Utilities Commission just ramped up a public comment period as it considers the future of this decades-old policy. When new housing or a commercial building goes up, service pipelines are needed. New properties often aren't charged for those connections, with the cost spread out among existing customers. Clean Heat Minnesota's Natalie Cook says with non-gas options like heat pumps now part of the mix, the allowances are outdated.
So new customers could still get gas service. They will need to just pay for it directly to connect to the gas system, and we think that's fair.
And if natural gas expansion slows, the coalition warns future rate increases to fund new connections will disproportionately impact renters and low-income households. Industry groups opposed to eliminating them say doing so would create difficulties for new customers. I'm Mike Moen.
And environmental groups are calling for greater regulation of tiny plastic pellets. They're accumulating in New England's waterways and elsewhere.
The pellets, which are melted down and shaped into water bottles, bags, and other items, are often spilled during manufacturing or transport. Lisa Frank with the advocacy organization Environment America says eventually these lentil-sized plastics find their way to the oceans, where they threaten both wildlife and public health.
They look just like fish eggs, which for lots of critters is a nutritious and delicious snack, but instead they wind up getting a belly full of plastic.
Research shows plastic pollution also fuels climate change. Darker pellets absorb more sunlight, and when mixed with snow and ice, they can lead to quicker snow melt. I'm Catherine Carley.
Finally, a group of clean water advocates in Iowa has filed a lawsuit in federal court challenging the Environmental Protection Agency's decision to back down on changes designed to ensure water safety in the state.
The Biden administration proposed a rule that would have imposed phosphorus emission limits on 126 meat industry plants across the U.S., including in Iowa. Phosphorus is the number one polluter of the nation's waterways. Now, the Trump administration has rescinded the proposed rules. Food and Water Watch staff attorney Danny Replegal argues that the EPA is more concerned about profits than safe drinking water for Iowans.
It was very clear from the record before EPA that this rule made sense, that there are slaughterhouses across the country that are already implementing the technologies that are going to achieve better water quality, and that the entire industry should be held to that standard.
The lawsuit was filed in the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm Mark Moran.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Spencer Graves of KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Today on Sprouts, Maria Stephan will discuss her work with Erica Chenoweth, comparing the relative effectiveness of violence and nonviolence. Other researchers have studied either violence or nonviolence. Chenoweth and Stephan are, from what I know, the international experts studying their relative effectiveness. Their book on why civil resistance works appeared in 2011. Not coincidentally, Chenoweth joined the Harvard faculty in 2018. Maria earned a PhD in law and diplomacy from the Fletcher School, then joined the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. From there, she took a position with the U.S. State Department as the lead foreign affairs officer for the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations before joining the U.S. Institute of Peace. She is currently co-lead and chief organizer with the Horizons Project, which serves as an organizing platform dedicated to strengthening multiracial democracy in the U.S. and globally. Maria, what are the most important things you want to communicate to our audience?
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Spencer, and thanks for inviting me to join your program. It's good to be with you all today. I think the main message, you know, every day we wake up and it seems like we're barraged with a series of crises here in the United States and around the world. You know, whether it's the rise in threats and political violence in the United States, kind of the resurgence of authoritarianism, we have the standard bearer of one of our main political parties promising to be a dictator on day one if reelected. We have recurrence of police brutality that's undermining kind of the basic human rights and civil liberties of Black Americans in this country. So there are a lot of challenges internationally. I'm sure we're all seized with the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, in the war between Israel and Hamas. We're following the continued bloodshed and humanitarian crisis in Sudan that has displaced, I believe, around 3 million people. We're seeing 2 years after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, a continuation of war and suffering there. You know, and all the environmental challenges, the climate crisis. So it seems, you know, that we're being hit on all sides. And something that we discuss a lot at the Horizons Project, which is focused on strengthening democracy here at home and also internationally, is the need to balance urgency with hope and agency. And so we need to continue to be seized with the reality of these challenges in the United States and internationally, these interconnected challenges, while at the same time going back to the fundamentals that we are capable of bringing about change. Any positive change in this country has come about as the result of people coming together across difference and using different forms of nonviolent action to challenge injustices and to bring about a better society and a better world. And so I think returning to some of those fundamentals, that nonviolent action, which is something I've focused on for about three decades, I still believe that nonviolent action is the most powerful force available to humankind.
What about your work with Chenoweth?
Arifa and I spent several years collecting data on all the known major violent and nonviolent campaigns from 1900 up, you know, through the century. These were maximalist campaigns. So these were major political campaigns challenging incumbent regimes and foreign military occupations. And so we were, you know, interested in which form of resistance, where the primacy of tactics were either violent or nonviolent, which campaigns had been more effective. And to cut a long story short, the major nonviolent campaigns were twice as successful as the armed insurgencies, succeeding about twice as often. The main reason for that was that the nonviolent campaigns attracted significantly higher and more diverse participation, were more likely to prompt loyalty shifts in the regime's key pillars of support, and were able to exert pressure and leverage much more effectively than the armed insurgencies. And the other part of the research, as you noted, Spencer, is that we found a very strong correlation between nonviolent resistance and democratization. As you noted, in about the 25% of campaigns where the violent insurgency was successful, so think about in northern Vietnam, think about Maoist China, Algeria, those campaigns were successful by our definition, but almost never, in less than, I believe, 3% of the cases, did the armed insurgencies then pave the way to a democracy. So often the regimes that emerged were more tyrannical, dictatorial, and often there was a relapse back into civil war following the success of armed insurgencies. So we found, the bottom line is that we found that not only were the nonviolent campaigns much more effective than the armed insurgencies in achieving their major goals, they were also much more likely to result in democratic and peaceful societies.
How was Israel fit in that pattern?
So, one interesting thing in my research, both in my dissertation and in the book Civilian Jihad, which is on the history of nonviolent struggle in the greater Middle East, and then also one of the chapters in Why Civil Resistance Works, was about the first Palestinian Intifada. So I was very interested as a scholar of civil resistance in when and why self-determination struggles succeeded. So I was very interested in kind of comparing Palestine, East Timor, and Kosovo. And so, you know, so one interesting thing to note, an important thing I think to note in this context, as this horrific tragedy continues to unfold in Gaza following the terrible Hamas attack on October 7th, is that there is actually a long history of Palestinian nonviolent resistance against the Israeli occupation. And we can lose sight of that, especially in moments like this. And I often would hear people asking, well, where's the Palestinian Gandhi? If only there were Palestinian Gandhis. And, you know, in fact, we know that there have been many Palestinian Gandhis, and in the leading proponents of nonviolent resistance have often been those who have been arrested, detained, deported, even assassinated. And so I, you know, was particularly interested in the first Palestinian Intifada, which was the uprising against the Israeli occupation in the late 1980s. And I was interested in that struggle, not because it was wholly successful. In our data set, in Why Civil Resistance Work, the first Intifada is coded as a partial success, meaning it paved the way to the negotiations and the Oslo Peace Accords, but it did not achieve meaningful self-determination, much less Palestinian statehood. But I was interested in that period of time, especially the first 18 months of the first Intifada, because I believe Palestinians achieved more in advancing their self-determination struggle during that 18-month period, when the primacy of tactics used were protests, boycotts, strikes, creating parallel education systems, victory gardens. So this whole range of nonviolent actions that involved every segment of Palestinian society. It was led by Palestinians in the occupied territories, not by the PLO on the outside that had been relying for decades on armed attacks and terrorism. This was an uprising led by Palestinians living under occupation. And I was very interested in the organization of the First Intifada, how the main came together to create a united national leadership, how they disseminated leaflets or bayonets that described the daily tactics of the Intifada, the massively participatory nature. So I think it's important to, even in this period, to recall that there is this history. The context has changed a lot since that time period. And the Oslo Accords, which brought to power, incidentally, the Oslo Accords brought to power a Palestinian authority that had been operating outside of the occupied territory. So those who were leading the First Intifada, this remarkable uprising, were sidelined. They were not the lead negotiators. And those who were representing Palestinians were those who had been fighting with armed insurgency on the outside for many, many years. And that became the Palestinian Authority. And so now the challenge is the Israeli bombardment following the very horrific Hamas action on October 7th has been disproportionate. 30,000 people have died, including 12,000 at least children, Palestinian children. And so the response is terrible. And so now the question becomes, what is the future? Like, how is it possible to reimagine a strategy of collective liberation and self-determination in this context? And I do still believe, notwithstanding all that is happening right now, that this continues to be the only way out of this terrible situation and the only way to achieve peace with justice for both people on both sides of the green line. And that is through nonviolent action and civil resistance. And that resistance has to include Palestinians inside the occupied territories, Israelis inside Israel and Palestinian citizens of Israel, and then people who are in other countries like the United States, whose government is firmly backing the occupation and backing a right-wing government right now. And so that continues for me to remain the main and possibility for the situation over there.
Talk about Mubarak Awad.
Mubarak Awad, Palestinian American, who played a very active role in the lead up to and during the first Palestinian Intifada, a leading proponent of nonviolence. He, you know, was conducting trainings in nonviolence in the territories, was involved in various nonviolent actions, and he was arrested and eventually deported by the Israeli government, you know, during that period of time. And so Mubarak, now as the founder, co-founder of Nonviolence International, has been very focused on strengthening nonviolence amongst Palestinians and raising awareness of what is happening over there, the dynamics of the occupation. I did interviews on both sides of the Green Line while writing my dissertation. And so I remember interviewing retired Israeli generals, IDF, Israeli Defense Force generals, and one in particular, you know, one of his responses when we were talking about what made the First Intifada different compared to other periods of Palestinian resistance. And he acknowledged that what was different was the mass participation. Everyone was participating, you know, women, children, professionals, workers, everybody was in. And he said, yeah, and we don't do Gandhi well, meaning the Israeli government and IDF had a difficult time responding to the mass participation in the uprising. And so, yes, the response was predictably repressive, with all the arrests, deportations, imprisonment, killings that happened during that time. But I would note that over the course of the First Intifada, there was coverage. It was very clear that this was, you know, an unarmed civilian population challenging a military occupation. And so there was a lot of media coverage. people may not know that there were a number of Israeli Jews who were actively participating in the campaigns of the First Intifada, so especially in the town of Beit Zahor. So there were joint Israeli-Palestinian actions. A number of American diaspora members came over, so there was a lot of solidarity action. For the very first time, when the news was covering the kind of disproportionate response and the repressive reaction of the Israeli government under then Shamir to the uprising, for the very first time, the United States withheld its veto in the United Nations when there was a resolution condemning the Israeli response. That was the first time that had happened. And so it's worth thinking about, you know, what would have prompted that response, that reaction, and, you know, to the difference of things, you know, events that transpire before and after. So, you know, that's the thing. When you study nonviolent resistance, the sad truth is that nonviolent kind of movements are almost always responded to with violence. It's like one of the most predictable things. But depending on what the movement itself does, is it able to maintain resilience, discipline, strategic focus? Is it able to maintain mass participation? That's what determines whether the violence backfires against the perpetrators, meaning they lose support, they lose the moral high ground because of their response, or whether that doesn't happen and people are paralyzed or they do nothing in response. And so anyway, so I think that period, you know, of the Palestinian struggle continues to be very instructive.
How did you meet Erica Chenoweth?
Yeah, so I, you know, I was at that time working at the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, which is an international nonprofit organization that is dedicated to developing, disseminating knowledge, know-how about strategic nonviolent action. You know, I joined ICNC after wrapping up my dissertation, and I was the director of educational initiatives during that time. And so one of the very early convenings that we hosted was a meeting in Colorado to talk about how educators and scholars are researching and teaching about nonviolent action. So it was a meeting. I remember it was called People, Power, and Pedagogy. And Erica was there. And I remember very, like, fortuitously and not planned at all, we were roommates. And so we ended up spending a lot of time at night talking about, like, well, you know, how often is nonviolent resistance really successful? You have all these classic cases of, like, you know, Indian independence movement and the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa and the Chilean movement that ousted Pinochet and the U.S. civil rights movement and the Polish solidarity movements. You have all these classic cases, but can nonviolent resistance really be effective in the most repressive environments? And is its track record really better than armed resistance? And the fact was, you know, nobody had attempted to systematically compare the two forms of resistance. So by the end of that gathering, basically on the back of a napkin, we had plotted out, you know, the table of contents for what became Why Civil Resistance Works.
You are listening to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Spencer Graves with KKFI Kansas City Community Radio, talking with Maria Stephan about her research into understanding the relative effectiveness of violence and nonviolence, and her work with the Horizons Project to strengthen multiracial democracy in the U.S. and globally.
What is the Horizons Project?
After working for decades on international issues, you know, I've been working with, you know, movements and activists all around the world who were fighting for rights, freedom, democracy, using civil resistance. You know, I had been studying authoritarianism, the dynamics of authoritarianism, how autocrats consolidate, maintain control, gut democratic institutions. And so having worked all these issues for so many years internationally, seeing what was happening in my own country, certainly, authoritarianism did not begin with the Trump administration. We have a long history of authoritarianism in this country. You know, think about Jim Crow, the system of racial apartheid in the South. That was a very quintessential form of single-party authoritarian rule that was at that time consolidated in the Democratic Party. Today, the authoritarian faction is consolidated in the Republican Party. And seeing like all the elements of the authoritarian playbook playing out in my backyard, I decided I needed to be able to focus more on what was happening in the United States. So I took a sabbatical from my work at the U.S. Institute of Peace, started to get involved with different democracy networks, peace building, bridge building networks, movements, groupings that were organizing under the Trump administration, where, you know, after the Muslim ban, you know, after the very anti-immigrant kind of sentiments, after, you know, all the things that were happening during that time period, the normalization of political violence and threats, you know, the announcement that, you know, if the election didn't go Trump's way, he would probably not recognize the results. So all these things that we know are part of the authoritarian playbook, you know, seeing that how focused it was in the United States, I needed to be able to focus much more on this. So the Horizons Project was being incubated at my colleague Julia Roy's old organization, Partners Global. Horizons was meant to be a platform to come together and bring different tools, perspectives, and approaches to address the crisis of democracy, the crisis of systemic racism, inequality, all these intersecting, reinforcing crises that we're facing using this variety of different tools and approaches. So that was kind of the impetus behind Horizons. We also very much bring in the international insights and perspectives. So not only what do we know about how authoritarians consolidate power, and you know, some of your listeners may be familiar with Protect Democracy's authoritarian playbook. It's a very useful guide that I commend to folks. I would also recommend to folks the online publication Just Security has developed an autocrat threat tracker for the U.S. So if you want to go into the very specifics of the kind of most significant threats to U.S. democracy in this moment and proposed responses and solutions, those two works, I think, are very, very helpful. So on a day-to-day basis, Spencer, we do a lot of organizing between different communities and constituencies. So we're working with movements, because the whole idea is like, whether you're working on racial justice, anti-poverty, reproductive rights, you know, environmental issues, all being affected by the attacks on democracy. So how can we build a movement of movements to be able to collectively respond? How can we bring in unlikely allies in the business sector, in the faith community, in the veterans community, in like, you know, professional associations? So a lot of our work is research, but also organizing across difference, across partisan ideology, across different sectors, to be able to stubbornly say no to authoritarianism in the U.S. and yes to a multiracial democracy. Just Security's autocratic threat tracker, I think it's just important to be aware of how, you know, institutions, democratic institutions are co-opted, are undermined, and all the things that we're seeing, the threats and political violence, the book bans, the anti-LGBTQ legislation, the anti-protester bills, the voter suppression that's happening at the state level. All of these things are part of a system, and there are ways to confront this system. So education about how authoritarianism functions, but then getting involved in organizing. I mean, for me, so much goes back to local, community, state, national, and eventually international organizing to be able to bring people together to address the challenges as they're playing out locally. And I can guarantee that the various components of the authoritarian playbook are probably happening in communities where, you know, your community is operating. So how do you find common cause, whether it's through church groupings, whether it's, you know, local community-based organizations? We need to be able to come together and strategize and prepare and train, because that is how we can get better at responding. One of the key findings from research is that training really matters. Training is important both to build skills. So, you know, how can we think about strategically sequencing nonviolent tactics? Can we think about the most likely scenarios to play out so that we can plan? What are the dialogue approaches to bring people together across difference? How do we call people in rather than calling them out? So there are very specific skills and tools that can be honed. And I think that's part of it, coming together, getting trained together, learning from other experiences. Protect Democracy is an organization that a national organization that is focused on various attacks on democracy and authoritarianism in the US. It's trying to prevent the United States from backtracking and becoming autocratic. And so Protect Democracy, if you go to their website, they have a lot of useful resources. The Authoritarian Playbook, I find very helpful. I also find they now have the Authoritarian Playbook for 2025, which is basically taking the statements and proposed actions of, not only Donald Trump and his closest advisors, what they've said they will do and kind of have brought them together. Because the one thing when you focus on authoritarianism, one of the key lessons is that when an autocrat says they will do something, believe them. They will try to do it. So anyway, that's one of the resources that brings kind of different kind of analyses and toolkits together. So that's Protect Democracy. The 22nd Century Initiative has been working with different movement organizations. They have a network meeting once a month that, again, brings people together from very different movements, very different states and parts of the country to come together around a shared analysis of what's happening and kind of how we can respond together. Race Forward, which is very focused on the nexus of racial justice and democracy. It's a question of how to build a movement of movements. I've been involved in the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative. There are different groupings and networks that regularly meet, strategize. So I'm thinking about the Trust Network, for example. This is a group of bridge building and peace building organizations that come together, highlight good things that are happening on the ground, different organization that is happening. They've been pioneering work on an early warning, early response system to address violence.
The Patriot Act makes it illegal to teach nonviolence to anyone designated as a terrorist by the U.S. State Department, according to the Supreme Court decision Holder versus the Humanitarian Law Project. Talk about that.
I would just say, without being a lawyer or a legal expert, there absolutely has to be ways to provide training to groups in strategic nonviolent action and nonviolent responses. And this is, you know, as I mentioned earlier, probably the strongest finding in the, you know, systematic analysis that Erica and I did of the role of external actors vis-a-vis nonviolent movements. So the training, the preparation, the planning, learning from other experiences is like the most effective way that outside actors can support nonviolent movements. So this is probably, and this is why the Horizons Project has been centering training so much and working with a cohort of trainers from across the US called the Growers Guild. These are civil resistors, these are organizers, these are conflict resolution people.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to Maria Stephan about her research in understanding the relative effectiveness of violence and nonviolence, and her work with the Horizons Project to strengthen multiracial democracy. More on this is available at kkfi.org, then News and Public Affairs, then All Souls Forum, then Multiracial Democracy. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's URSULA at pacifica.org. I'm Spencer Graves with KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Thank you for listening and see you next week on Sprout.
Hey, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thanks.
To this interview. So tell us a little bit about your jobs and what does a faculty curator do?
I'm Christine Weber. I'm the curator of the Northview Gallery. We start by meeting with, well, actually by sending out a call for artists. So that's kind of the first step towards getting local artists, regional artists to propose shows for the gallery. Then we convene our exhibition advisory board, who with us reviews all the proposals, and we spend a lot of time talking about what's going to work well with our curriculum, relate to and engage with as many programs as possible on our campuses, and really be valuable as teaching tools within our academic setting. Once we decide on the exhibitions that we're going to mount that year, then the really fun and enjoyable work starts.
And then with like a lot of the sort of back end things you have dealing with the press release and how you want the artist's voice to come out to the public in order to bring people into the show. I'm Zainab Saab and I am the gallery director at the Cascade campus. And you also have kind of what Christine said too with bringing students, you also have students that work in the gallery and training them and teaching them like how to install a show, how to deinstall a show, and just how to be a gallery attendant.
Yeah, the level of professional development that students who work with us get is pretty phenomenal.
And it's like a benefit for them too, like get to know their community.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really exciting part where people come up to them and they're like, who's this artist? What's this show about?
It helps the students not feel so intimidated about walking into galleries.
Right.
I'm Petra Sirenen, and I'm the curator at the Helzer Gallery at PCC Rock Creek.
So how do students usually experience the galleries? And what role do they play in campus life?
We do a lot of workshops with our artists. So I ask each artist if they want to do a workshop with the students. And so then I would pair them up on a day that, say, printmaking is meeting. And they'll come and give their artist talk on that day and then do a workshop with that group of students, plus outside of students who want to participate in that. So they get real one-on-one time with the artists and get to know them better that way. Mm-hmm. The artist talks are always a big draw. We get a lot of people coming in. It's usually pretty crowded.
Yeah.
We sit on the floor.
The workshops always tend to be so exciting because students are actually getting to make work with the artists. There's something about that kind of like real time.
It breaks the wall for me. Like, I think that's what it is, where it's like you get to see the artist working versus the artist talking really formally about their practice. And there's like a level of like intimidation I'm sure students feel, where it's like in real time, show you their process. And that way it kind of turns like for the student from, oh, this is an artist, but they're also an instructor too. So then it kind of welcomes them in a little bit because of that familiarity of like, oh, you're teaching me something.
Anna Fiddler came in and her work is kind of spiritually based and very intuitive. And she has this practice of making little postcard sized pieces that are just really begin with a couple words or thoughts that are in her head and then become a very intuitive painting process. So she did those cards with our students in painting. And it was really interesting to see what came out of that. And they sat quietly for 3 hours doing these intense little drawings. And then everyone displayed them and kind of talked about them. We also had a workshop with Andrew Myers, who does work exploring kind of wolves and the territoriality of wolves. And he did a printmaking workshop with our students where he had this kind of collaged giant piece in the gallery and the students added to it. They made prints and then he collaged them into the show as the show was going on.
There was that show that really, Muna Hanedi show with the kites.
Yeah.
And the power of that show and doing the kite workshop That was a really beautiful experience.
The kite workshop was wonderful, and we were able to display the kites made by ESOL students for the rest of the year. And so they had their work on view in the building that they had made, you know, with Mona.
Yeah.
That was a really beautiful show, and that was probably one of my favorite workshops from this year. The workshop was drawn from an exhibition, an artist, Nimon Khunedi, who's a Palestinian-American artist and wanted to respond to the violence happening in Gaza, and created a gallery full of kites, an installation essentially, filling the gallery with kites, including video projection and sound that she drew from archival footage from reporters. Her interest was in part in honoring all of the reporters who have lost their lives, attempting to communicate to the world about the violence, and wanted to engage students around the object of a kite. And it was really beautiful, both her and Hamid Nabil, who was an expert on the design of kites specifically from Gaza, talked about their experience flying kites as children and how a symbol, how meaningful the kite was. And then a lot of the students, because it was a really global group from ESOL, were talking about their own experiences flying kites, and those kites have remained up in the building, and it's lovely to have kind of a evidence of the workshop and evidence of students' creativity and engagement with the artists that that we're able to see in the building long after the exhibition is gone.
So tell us about the student art show. How does this show enhance the experience of art students at the college?
So the student art exhibition is taking place in all three galleries, and students had the chance to choose whichever gallery was either most convenient to them or closest to them.
So students have the opportunity to see their work, you know, professionally on a wall with a label in the context with a lot of other students that are working as they are. And I mean, I think we all probably have that experience at our awards reception where a student brings their family and pulls them over to their work, and their family sees that work hanging there, and then they're able to talk about the class or the assignment, and it's just this really beautiful moment.
It's also like their first opportunity to show their work. And we keep that application pretty professional, so they're having to answer the questions that a professional artist would and provide us with images and dimensions and titles and things like that and an explanation about the work. I have actually a student who is showing at the Northview Gallery, and he's had a lot of struggles. Like, he has accommodations for learning disabilities, and he was so happy that the show was up, and he was like, two of my pieces got selected. I just didn't think that they were good enough. But I could see how he was so much more engaged in class today just because of that experience of being chosen for the show.
The students do learn a lot about, you know, how do you communicate your work to someone else? You have to think about photographing the work, titling it, as you were saying, you know, writing a little bit about it. So all those are things that, if they do decide to pursue art professionally, are super valuable to have an experience with.
So what's the current situation for funding the arts at PCC?
Well, I'm gonna just be frank, speak from our perspective as gallery directors and the labor we put into the shows and the funding that we need to put into those shows. Even with the funding we're given now, it always feels like it's not enough. At least for the Paragon, a good majority of it goes to the artists. So kind of what Christine said, when we have our open call and we select our artists for the year, we reserve a certain amount of money for each artist. We have a small section of it as well for supplies, and another section of it goes to our assistants. It always feels like I wish I could give the artists more. And so for us right now, we are looking at our budgets potentially being cut. I feel like there's a really good chance that is going to happen just from the conversations we've been having, but it is certain that our release time is being cut. That's going to impact the quality and time we can put into our practice as directors. And that is such a shame, honestly. So a course release is, there's a set amount of courses that a full-time faculty teaches within the year. So as a gallery director, we get a release from the amount of classes that we teach in order to fulfill the position of being a gallery director.
I really feel what you're saying, Zainab, about wanting to pay our artists more. The artists who come to our campuses and engage with our students put so much time and effort, not only into their exhibitions, but then also into the mm-hmm. events and the programming. And we already, yeah. We struggle to try to pay what would be comparable to what other arts institutions can pay, right. But we just don't have a large enough budget to yeah. do so.
When I first started doing this, which is 7 years ago, I used to joke that this was a full-time job on top of my full-time job. Mm-hmm. But back then, I had 20 hours a week of an assistant, and I'm potentially looking at not having an assistant next year. And I really don't know how I can manage this mm-hmm. on my own.
Like, the burnout really does come from fighting for the things we need that are the bare minimum. That is where the really big fight comes in, where it's like, I have no problem spending hours with the artist to get this show up. It's exhausting, but it's exciting, and knowing the potential of it. But the exhausting part really is going through all of that red tape for the bare minimum.
This is, it's a dream thing that we get to do. We're very lucky that we get to talk with students and artists in a gallery about art. Like, it's amazing. I would do it for free, but it's really impossible to imagine actually having the time to program the events, to work with the artists, to connect with classes, mm-hmm. to write the press release and try to reach out to the community beyond our college walls if we don't have time to do that. And that really is where the release time, being able to not teach a class, to have that time instead to do the gallery work, is extremely valuable.
We need to firmly state too, we are a professional gallery. Each one of us runs a professional gallery. And for these cuts to come in, to me at least, feels like we're not able to be at the standard that we are currently at right now.
Well, it seems like the arts are constantly in danger of losing funding. In our current moment, what is the particular importance of funding the arts, especially on a community college campus?
We've just been seeing so many emails and Instagram posts from significant arts organizations in the city who lost their NEA grants, and it is heartbreaking. It's devastating. And so I think that, you know, in the context of PCC, if we can do one small thing in keeping these three galleries open, and then, you know, potentially finding ways to support and promote the other arts organizations in the city that are mm-hmm. that are, you know, struggling, we have to do it. I mean, we need artists, writers, performers, musicians more than ever now, because we are a community college. Many of our students with art in the art galleries right now are not art majors, and they're not planning to pursue that field. But think about the power of introducing every single human who comes through our doors to the fact that they too have the potential to create, to make something with their own hands, to tell their story to anyone who enters the gallery and will listen. I think that's something that we don't want to give up on. Mm-hmm. And to me seems really important, particularly in this world where there's the potential of things coming in to take over our creative capabilities. You know, when I can push a button and AI will do it for me. I think it's really vital for us to provide these spaces where anyone can have access to their own creative power.
Hello, X-Ray listeners, and welcome again to Jazz in Portland. I'm Thomas Smith, here with Tom Skelly.
Hello, Thomas.
Here are some events for the week of September 22nd. Monday, September 22nd, at Joe Bourne Rotisserie at Papa Haydn, 715 Northwest 23rd Avenue, Blue Note Mondays, 7 to 10 p.m. Tuesday, September 23rd at Pizzario, 337 East Main Street, Hillsboro, Laura Kennard's Jazz Jam, 7 to 10 p.m. Wednesday, September 24th at Wilf's, 800 Northwest 6th Avenue at Union Station, Ron Steen's Vocal Showcase featuring Susan Westby, 7 to 9 p.m. Thursday, September 25th at Bar Batalon, 606 Northeast Davis Street, Shirley Rudolph and Friends, 6 p.m. Friday, September 26th at the 1905 830 North Shaver Street just off Mississippi, Bobby Torres Ensemble, 6:30 and 8:30, then the late set, Randy Porter Quintet, 10:15 p.m. At Wilf's at Union Station, Tony Pacini Jazz Piano Trio, 7 to 9:30 p.m. Saturday, September 27th at Amalfi's Italian Restaurant, 4703 Northeast Fremont Street, Cheryl Alex and Son Cubano, 6 to 9 p.m. At Conway's House of Jazz, 16100 Southeast 82nd Drive, Greenhouse Center in Clackamas, Anandi and Friends, Paul K. Ward, Bill Athens, and Ron Steen, 7 to 10 p.m. Sunday, September 28th, at Al's Den, 303 Southwest 12th Avenue, Chance Hayden's Desert Room All-Stars, 7 p.m. Stay tuned for more info on jazz in Portland and streaming everywhere at xray.fm. Thanks for listening. Enjoy Portland music.
Good morning. You're listening to X-Ray FM, KXRY Portland at 91.1 FM. K296 FT West Haven, serving Portland at 107.1 FM. And K219 KU Nehalem, serving Nehalem, Wheeler, Manzanita, and Rockaway Beach at 91.7 FM. Streaming live and archived at xray.fm, where radio is yours. It is 7:55 and not yet the top of the hour. So you might hear me do that again in 5 minutes. All right, but I'm starting this all off 5 minutes early at the Commons. Good morning, you all. This is your Monday morning radio guide to news, culture, and local action. Start your week informed with stories that matter to you and your neighbors, spotlighting people and events shaping Portland's future environmentally, socially, and economically. With a focus on direct action, union organizing, and the thriving local art scene, we're here to help you play the cards in your hand and make a difference. Whether you're tuning in for the news, the music, or the opportunity to act, the Commons is where Portland gathers. And yes, you do not hear Hannah say that with me. So sad. She is not with us in the studio this morning because she is traveling, and we love that for her. I'm your host, Julia Moore. Hannah will be back in a couple weeks. It is now 7:56, 1 minute later, on Monday, September 22nd. And coming up, we have a few things. We have updates on parking in Portland. We did quite a bit of talking about that about a month ago. The city was going to hike up those prices, but I don't know. Maybe they're doing a U-turn. And then we have some more news from Portland and some music coming to town. Remember, you can text in here to the station. I actually have the message list pulled up right now, so I will see your message, and I might even read it on air. So send me some cool stuff. Send me some cool stuff, and I'd love to talk to you. The text line is 971-220-KXRY or 971-220-5979. All right, folks, let's get into the weather. So there's a high of 72 and a low of 52 for today. It's looking like it's going to be sunny this week. We got some surprise rain. I think that was yesterday morning. Yeah, yesterday was Sunday. We got some surprise rain yesterday. It was so cloudy. I was like, oh my goodness, is it finally fall? And then by 9 a.m., it had totally burned off. I was like, okay, we're doing this, which is great because I planted some pumpkin seeds late in the season, and I'm really hoping for some pumpkins. Everyone tells me I'm not going to get them because, you know, the frost is going to hit and then the fruit's going to die. But as we know, the climate is changing, which is bad, you know. We don't want global warming to be happening, but potentially as a result, I might have pumpkins. So send good vibes to my pumpkins. Hopefully they continue to grow. And I really think that this sun this week is going to help. On Tuesday, there's a high of 83. On Wednesday, high of 82. So we're getting some sun. And then on Friday and Saturday, we're getting back into the cloudy time. So yeah, that doesn't bode well for my pumpkins. But I'm in denial. I'm going to get pumpkins. All right. Let's get into some news. We're going to be shifting back and forth this morning between some news and some music, some news and some music. So, yeah, I think it's good. It's good for our processing, right? We take in some information and then, you know, we chill and we think to some tunes. I'm really glad to be with you all this morning. It is now 7:59. That